You will remember nothing. You will remember nothing. You will remember nothing. Nothing. You will remember nothing. You will remember nothing.
That's not mine. Nice transmitter.
Thank you. get some
Let me
rest.
Tell you something about an ABC style. 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 Let me tell you something about an ABC style. Let me tell you something about an ABC style. Let me tell you something about an ABC style. Let me tell you something about an ABC style.
Get some rest. 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 Get some rest.
Oh.
Get some rest.
Oh.
Get some rest. Get some rest. Get some rest. Get some rest.
On August 11th, 1983, John A. K., 29, of Chatsworth, California, was burned over the entire lower half of his body in trying to rescue his dog from a hot spring at Midway Geyser Basin. Including David Allen Kerwin's dog, Kay's was the fourth dog to be injured or killed in Yellowstone Hot Springs that summer. That dogs occasionally died in hot springs very early in Yellowstone's history was attested to some years ago by Bessie Haynes Arnold, who remembered that it happened at least once while she lived in the park between 1883 and 1904 and 1914 to 1916, and at least one other such dog incident is known from that same period. Dog hot spring incidents and most human hot spring incidents tend to occur in summer. However, John Mark Williams' injury and subsequent death in a hot spring was not only the sole thermal death to occur in winter, but also a springboard for what was possibly the most complex winter search and rescue operation ever to be assembled in Yellowstone. Williams, 24, had been a park employee pub tender at Lake, and during the winter of 1987-88, he was an employee at Old Faithful Snow Lodge. Originally from Wetumpka, Alabama, he was the kind of person nearly everyone liked. Blonde, blue-eyed, intelligent, athletic, sensitive to nature, outgoing, and happy. He was in excellent physical shape and a strong skier and rock climber. On Monday and Tuesday, February 7th and 8th, 1988, a party of Snow Lodge employees winter camped near Shoshone Geyser Basin on Shoshone Lake, some 11 miles south of Old Faithful. The party consisted of Jack McConnell, Jill Fitterer, Andrea Paul, Melanie Weeks, and John Mark Williams. All were experienced Yellowstone employees of several years each, and all were excellent skiers and winter campers in good physical shape. Weeks and Paul skied in on the 7th, Fitterer and McConnell skied in together on the 8th, Williams skied in alone on the 8th, and joined the others that evening. Weeks and Paul were skiing out on the 8th when they met Fitterer and McConnell heading in, heard that Williams was to join the party, and decided to go back in. Andrea Paul was to be eternally thankful that she went back. On February 8th, the group made camp at 5 o'clock p.m. It was not a legal camp, as they were assigned to a campsite spot, but instead camped on the shore of the lake. Although rangers would later criticize them for the decision, several party members were to note later that the decision to camp there was a common-sense one, based on the incoming storm, rather than any conscious disregard of park policy. John Mark Williams had been fascinated by the beauty of the Shoshone Hot Springs on earlier trips, and decided to go for a walk in the Geyser Basin, while the others stayed behind to cook dinner. Perhaps John Mark wanted to see the beauty of the springs in the snow and engage in some quiet contemplation. Or perhaps he wanted to do some illegal hot spotting, soaking in the cooler of the thermal pools. And there are not many springs that fit that description. He may have also needed some time alone to do some thinking about his prior relationship with Andrea, a relationship that had lasted several years and had ended the summer before. He invited the others to join him, and when they declined, he headed out into the geyser basin alone. It was not yet dark, and was snowing only lightly at that moment, but the storm was to roll in quickly. By 6 o'clock p.m., it had begun snowing a little harder, and darkness was fast approaching. Jack, Jill, Melanie, and Andrea finished eating, cleaned up their pots, and started settling into their sleeping bags. By 6:45, the visibility had grown very poor from heavy snowfall, gusty winds, and dense hot spring vapor. Indeed, Ranger Bonnie Gaffney, soon to be heavily involved in the incident, would note later that while the storm was raging, the howling wind was incredible. When Gaffney opened the patrol cabin door on the shore of Shoshone Lake, where she was spending the night, she couldn't even see the lake for the blowing wind and howling snow. As time passed, the four campers grew concerned about William, so Melanie and Andrea set out with headlamps into the dark. Blowing snow and darkness kept them from being able to see well despite their lights, and they quickly realized that heavy snow drifting was occurring so fast that they could not figure out which way to go. Confused and disoriented, they gave up after 10 minutes and returned to the tent. "I hope John Mark is okay," Andrea commented upon their return to the tents. "Old Henry," a nickname of John's, "is probably loving it out there," was McConnell's confident reply. But then he quietly noted to Jill, "Something is wrong. He should have been back by now. And I've got a bad feeling." Shortly after that, around 7:30 p.m., the four tent occupants heard screaming in the distance, then silence, punctuated only by the moaning wind and the sound of snowflakes slapping the sides of the tent. Then they heard screaming again. "Oh, God, help me, help me!" As all four scrambled to get out of their sleeping bags, the screaming grew closer. Exiting their tents, the others saw Williams in a stumbling run, holding his arms above his head and crying, "My hands, my hands, I hurt so bad." McConnell asked Williams what had happened, and in broken words he answered, "Oh God, I fell in a real hot one. I'm hurting real bad." Moving quickly, the others stripped off Williams' wet clothes and placed him in a sleeping bag. He had been scalded from his feet to his neck. Long strips of his skin had already begun to peel off from the second and third degree burns, which covered 90% of his body. The others elevated his feet in an attempt to treat him for shock, while his screams of pain filled the tent. Jill Fitterer remembers the screams being painfully long and loud, sounds she could not get out of her head for years. She was shocked to see that his back was now a deep purple in color. "I'm asking for help," said McConnell. Jill told him that he could not go alone, and that she would go too. Jack replied that was okay, but to pack faster than she had ever packed before. Jill scrambled for anything warm she could find. The two struck out in the darkness, hoping to find Ranger Bonnie Gaffney and Steve Blakely, who they knew were staying in the Cove patrol cabin 3 miles away. Unfortunately, they did not know exactly where the cabin was. Jack's headlamp bulb burned out, so he stopped to replace it with another. The second one shattered, and they had only Jill's fading light. To conserve its battery, they skied in darkness, sliding backwards often and falling several times while following Bonnie and Steve's dim ski tracks. Those tracks finally ended, covered by the new snow that had been long falling. They yelled for Bonnie and Steve over and over, to no avail. From a mile away, John Mark's screams cut through them like a hot knife. Jill was exhausted, but kept up with Jack in terror of their being separated. In pitch darkness, she skied into low tree branches and fell again. The wind and falling snow were ruthless and unforgiving. Unable to find the cabin, the two decided to return to Snow Lodge for help. The relatively warm temperature of 20 degrees Fahrenheit was their only relief. Meanwhile, Melanie and Andrea had begun desperate attempts to keep Williams alive. Every few minutes, they gave him fruit juice or water. When that ran out, they attempted to melt snow in a pan, but the wind kept blowing out the stove. They ended up melting snow in their mouths and spitting it into a cup. Meanwhile, McConnell and Jill were heading toward Grant's Pass and Old Faithful, knowing their inbound ski tracks would be long concealed by the new snow. Jack McConnell, the strongest skier in the party, went first, breaking trail. Jill followed, but 3 miles out lost her energy. She fell over and over, skis twisting under her, and heard herself yelling in the blackness for Jack. Jill decided to stop and camp in order to keep from slowing Jack down. It was 10:45 p.m. The two made her a bivouac spot under a large tree. There she laid down to spend a cold, sleepless, lonely, and terrified snowbound night. The next day she skied out to Old Faithful. She wrote later that she hoped never again to feel so detached from life or to know such a great emptiness in her heart. Throughout the night, Andrea and Melanie maintained their heartbreaking vigil in thick snowfall and with winds blowing so hard that the tent threatened to collapse. John Mark Williams never lost consciousness and remained coherent during the night. Between screams of pain, he was able to carry on a conversation and expressed concern that McConnell would not possibly be able to return to Snow Lodge in the midst of such a fierce storm. He was alert enough to tell Andrea where his first aid kit was located, and at times he even sat up. He stated at one point that he didn't believe a helicopter could make it to the site, even if Jack were able to get help. While the women kept busy, they were consumed by their feelings. Andrea thought to herself that she hoped never to see another person in that much pain again. But after a while, she came to regard the screams as a necessary release for John. As she was later to explain, to touch anything or to be touched by anything was excruciatingly painful for him. I remember thinking, oh God, just let him pass out, let him rest. Melanie Weeks remembers thinking that she had never known such a feeling of helplessness as I knew that night. As the night stretched on, John often said he was so tired and continued to thank the two women for their efforts. He repeatedly apologized for the inconvenience and expressed concern about a coat he had dropped in the hot spring. He had borrowed it from a fellow employee at Snow Lodge, Andrea remembered, and he was quite concerned that the employee wouldn't get his coat back. I recall him saying that he was scared only twice, but a few times he said things like, I'm fighting, I'm trying. He kept popping up and then flopping down, writhing in pain and occasionally sobbing in frustration. He was so good about doing what we asked, explained Andrea, turning on his side repeatedly so we could try and get the sleeping bag zipper up around his neck, and sipping the water we gave him slowly. The girls took turns all night long, crawling out of the tent to gather snow in a small cooking pot. When the stove failed to light, they again melted small handfuls in their mouths, letting it slowly dribble back into a cup, which they handed to John every few minutes. The storm continued to rage. The walls of the tent shuddered, and the tent poles creaked, threatening to snap in two. Melanie and Andrea fought to keep snow from blowing in and kept snow-filled water bottles next to their skin in hopes that their body heat would melt more snow. Eventually, the powerful wind proved too much for the tent door zipper, and it broke. The two women were then kept twice as busy keeping snow out of the tent while preparing and administering liquids to Williams. Not once, remembers Andrea, I repeat, not once did he say he wanted to die, nor did he ever curse or get mad about this twist of fate. Not once did he say, why me? Instead, she explained, he kept thanking us. At one point, he even reached up to barely caress a strand of my hair and told me he loved me. Andrea remembers wondering if Jack would get through. Meanwhile, Jack McConnell skied on alone through the night, through high winds and with no source of light, but fortunately with the blowing snow at his back. The snow was so deep, the wind so high, and the night so dark that it was very difficult to find the trail. McConnell, a longtime Yellowstone employee and very experienced in the backcountry, had the presence of mind to leave the trail in favor of the Firehole River and to ski along the river, following its sound. He skied all night long and finally made it to Old Faithful Snow Lodge at 4 o'clock a.m. He saw the night security guard, and they dialed 911 together and informed the dispatcher of the situation. The park's chief ranger was immediately notified, and a massive search and rescue operation began to lurch slowly into operation. Old Faithful rangers did not want to begin the rescue until daylight because of the numerous dangers that could face the rescuers in darkness. At 7:30 a.m., rangers Bruce Blair and Steve Sarles packed their skis and some other gear and jumped onto a double-track snowmobile. Their plan was to try to drive the machine over the ski trail via Grant's Pass. That would be difficult at best, as the trail crossed the Continental Divide, rising and falling through thick timber with many small streams to serve as impediments. Moreover, the weather forecast was for continued heavy snow with high winds causing blowing and drifting. A snowmobile was likely to bog down in the deep drifts of the now full-blown blizzard. Nevertheless, Blair and Sarles gritted their teeth and headed into the swirling snowstorm. Skiing behind them, and at times in front of them, were two strong concessioner skiers from Snow Lodge, Kurt Langer and Dave Halliday. By 8:30 a.m., when Blair and Sarles were 5 miles in, other rangers heard their faint, static-filled radio reports of howling winds, low visibility, and 6-foot drifts. The rescue itself was now filled with innumerable risks, and the rescuers themselves were increasingly susceptible to dangers. Other rangers were coming from the south and the west entrances to make backup attempts to reach Shoshone Lake via the DeLacy Creek Trail. More than 20 people are now involved in the outdoors part of the rescue, but it was evident that it would take many hours to reach Williams. No one knew if he were even still alive. Ranger and park medic Bonnie Gaffney was spending her days off at Shoshone's Lake Cove patrol cabin. As per standard procedure, she turned her radio on that morning about 8 o'clock a.m., and the very first thing she heard was Shirley, the dispatcher, calling her number, 413-413. This is 700. Gaffney was shocked and responded immediately with strong apprehension. Informed of the situation by the dispatcher, she radioed that she and Steve Blakely were packing her medical gear for a ski trip to Williams campsite. Although the ranger staff could now breathe easier, knowing that a trained medic was within striking distance of the injured man, they did not know how truly severe were his injuries. Gaffney and Blakely struck out through the trees, wondering what horrors awaited them. Bonnie carried oxygen, first aid supplies, food, water, and all of her extra clothing. The blizzard made their travel more difficult as they tracked through unbroken snow directly across the frozen lake. Bonnie noted that their tracks from the previous day were completely obliterated. I was skiing faster than Steve and was also pumping on an adrenaline rush as I pushed on ahead and left him to follow my tracks. We were skiing into the wind this time, and eyelashes quickly froze as the snow hit your face like stinging needles. You had to keep your head down and lift it only to verify your direction of travel. We were breaking another 8 to 10 inches of snow this time. As we went, I was hearing radio traffic about the incident and could hear bits and pieces of rescue plans. I tried to talk to Steve Sarles in dispatch a number of times, but had to stop skiing to do so and didn't want to waste time. My impressions were of some thermal burns, but nothing to the extent that they were. I was thinking of foot and possibly leg burns. At 10:03 a.m., Gaffney radioed that they had reached the geyser basin and needed to know where the campsite was. Sarles replied from Grant's Path with information he had. At 10:37, the two reached the thermal pool that they believed was the site of the incident because a water bottle was floating in it and clothing was scattered around. Bonnie recognized John Mark's clothing from the preceding day when she and Steve had run into him on the trail. Somehow she had known it was he who had been hurt without ever having been told. For the next nearly 50 minutes, Gaffney and Blakely searched for the campsite. splitting up for efficiency, but wasting precious energy floundering in deep snow. Bonnie radioed several times to report she could not find the camp in the blizzard. All ski tracks were obliterated by that time. Finally, a good suggestion was radioed to her from Ranger Andy Fisher, who suspected that the group had camped on the beach. Back at the tent, Andrea and Melanie were still trying desperately to help John Mark. Andrea was to remember it vividly. I was sitting by John's head and had just handed him the cup with a few sips of water. He drank them down, sat slightly up to hand me the cup and said, "Thank you." As he flopped back, his eyes seemed to roll up and his jaw suddenly clenched. I feared he was going comatose and that he might swallow his tongue. I tried to pry open his mouth and force a yellow bandana between his teeth when I heard this strange gurgling sound. I now know that his lungs were filling with fluid. But at the time, I just thought he was choking. I had his head between my hands, and suddenly I knew he was no longer breathing or moving. Indeed, he seemed suddenly at peace. I was looking at him in total disbelief and shock. I couldn't believe he was really gone. I remember covering his nose and trying to breathe down his mouth, but nothing helped. Melanie and I were holding each other. I remember saying the words of the Lord's Prayer, crying, and lying there in disbelief. We were so totally exhausted and so in shock, we didn't react for a few minutes. I remember closing his eyelids, kissing him on the forehead. The thought that he was really gone was totally unacceptable. After 20 or 30 minutes, a calm resolve set in. In a stupor, the two women vacillated between packing up their things or just waiting for help. Andrea found her watch and remembers thinking that it said 10:30. So John Mark must have died sometime around 9:50 a.m. At 11:26, Bonnie Gaffney topped over a small hill in thigh-deep snow to see a blue tent on the beach and notified headquarters. The two women heard her shout and crawled out of the tent crying quietly, "Bonnie, it's too late. Nothing can help him now." Gaffney and Blakely began immediate CPR on Williams, and Melanie spelled them at intervals. At 11:54, Gaffney reported via radio to a doctor that she was getting no pulse or respiration. Eyes were fixed and dilated, skin blistered over 70% of the body, some lividity, a slight rigor in the arms, and no rectal temperature. At 12:25, the doctor ordered CPR to be stopped. Heroic efforts by Jack McConnell and Bonnie Gaffney, notwithstanding, and valiant, if initially delayed, efforts by the other Rangers, Sarles and Blair, along with Langer and Halliday, arrived shortly after Gaffney. Help had missed reaching Williams alive by an hour and a half. The pool he had fallen into, located immediately northwest of Black Sulphur Spring, was 187 degrees Fahrenheit and 8 feet deep. One could debate the what-ifs in this incident forever. Indeed, those debates continued for some time within the park surface, as they always do with dramatic incidents, in order to analyze the performances of both the rescuers and the rescued for the benefits of similar future incidents. Had Williams' party known where Bonnie Gaffney's cabin was, or had the storm been less fierce so that her ski tracks could have been followed, Williams might, but I really don't think so, have had a better chance for survival, for Gaffney could certainly have gotten the rescue rolling before midnight and perhaps as early as 8:15 p.m. On the other hand, getting a helicopter to the location in the storm was probably impossible, even if things had gotten rolling faster. If he had known its location, McConnell could have skied the 3 miles to Bonnie's cabin in perhaps half an hour. Then again, Gaffney might have found the camp more quickly had the party camped in their assigned site instead of camping illegally on the beach. But would that have really mattered? What if John Mark had not gone walking that night? What if Bonnie had left her radio on all night? What if the weather had been better? What if others had known CPR? And on and on. Despite these questions, Andrea and Jill both argue that it is futile to debate the what-ifs, that in light of John Mark's extensive injuries, he had no chance for survival once he fell into that pool. Andrea was there. She saw the severity and enormity of his situation all night long. A fire captain later described it to her thusly. If he were burned to that degree in the doorway of the best burn center in the country in Salt Lake City, he still would have died. The passage of more than 15 hours with no medical treatment for Williams was most unfortunate, but probably could not have been helped. And one can argue, as Andrea does most convincingly, that Williams' burns were so severe that nothing could have been done regardless of time. According to the autopsy report, they covered 90% of his body and he died of dehydration from the burns. According to Chief Ranger Dan Sholley, John Mark Williams had a reputation for pushing his limits in Yellowstone's backcountry, although Williams' compatriots certainly do not agree with that assessment. A park employee who was far more experienced than most visitors, Williams nevertheless became the victim of a fatal misstep, for whatever reason. In a strange coincidence, Williams' park roommate earlier had been Kent Shane Rich, a man who died falling off a mountain in the park in Deaths from Falls. So Williams had previously been close to a backcountry death, and according to Andrea, had been deeply affected by it. Two hard and fast rules in Yellowstone have to be these. Do not walk or ski in a thermal area in darkness or in blizzard conditions because you cannot see the hazards. And always camp in your assigned backcountry site. One of the reasons for the camping rule here was to keep people away from the geyser basin at night. Although the Park Service, ever aware of its potential legal liability because of visitors who sue, could argue that camping illegally caused problems in this case, Andrea Paul believes that John Mark would have died regardless of where they were camped. She points out that the trip to Shoshone was Bonnie Gaffney's first into the area, so Bonnie did not know the area well either. In fact, many of the party members noted that several of the rangers did not know the area well, if at all, and most were unhappy with the way they were treated by the rangers. It seemed to them incongruous that their rescuers would blame them for an incident that occurred in a place the rangers themselves barely knew. On the other hand, emergency personnel are not often well received by survivors in a death incident. Andrea Paul remembers this above all. When Jack, Jill, Melanie, and I first reached Shoshone Geyser Basin, we heard a jubilant shout as we broke from the trees and skied onto the open field which sits on the edge of the basin. John Mark was in high spirits, delighted to see us, and singing at the top of his lungs. My mama is a mountain lion, my daddy is a grizzly bear, and I'm the meanest mountain man this side of the Missouri River. I choose to remember him this way, wrote Andrea later, joyful, giddy, and seemingly invincible. Williams' death brought the total of human deaths from hot springs in Yellowstone National Park to 19. However, the total would be 20 if L.R. Piper's 1900 disappearance was due to his falling into a hot spring. The possibility of that having happened is very real. A more recent thermal injury in the park may have occurred partly because of an employee's intoxication in darkness. Joseph Widelock, 17, was traveling off-trail in a thermal area just after midnight on July 18, 1991, when he fell into a pool of Old Faithful's Myriad Group that measured 147 degrees Fahrenheit. Climbing out of the pool, he continued on in the darkness and fell into a second, even hotter one. Climbing out of that one, he attempted to stand up and fell into the same one again. He sustained first, second, and third degree burns over 67% of his body. Injuries and deaths in Yellowstone's hot springs are sobering and scary. Hot spring injuries probably number 100 or more. I cannot emphasize enough to parents that they must hold fast to their children when walking around Yellowstone's thermal area. As a four-year-old child, I was led around Yellowstone on a rope. I remember resenting the leash my parents put on me, but my father was very aware of hot springs, and I may be still alive because of it. Visitors must never travel off-trail in thermal areas, and all persons must exercise reasonable care when traveling through any thermal area. Heart-wrenching events, such as those I have mentioned, should teach us at least that. And then there was the Michael Pepe stepping in the hot springs incident. Yes, I do believe Michael Pepe was involved. It says so right here. See, Michael Pepe.
Oh, it does.
Well, you know, I think there's just a little miscommunication problem.
Well, we'll just have to tell him here on his answer machine. Or voicemail, as he likes to say, so it sounds more important.
Hey, it looks like somebody's calling in to pledge their drive now.
Actually, we're calling out two self-same supposed caller who was supposed to call.
I'm thinking about changing this voicemail greeting.
Oh, great.
The old self-same caller.
I'll just leave this one on.
Okay, why don't you change that thing, buddy?
And while you change it, we will begin watching the French New Wave classic, Les Bons Fins.
You can hang up and your message will be sent.
Okay, thanks. I love that digi lady. And maybe Michael Pepe will find out, but look at this secret film I found underneath the rescue party.
This delightful
that
effervescent
rescue party was
bit
great,
of
by the way.
French froth is delightful to the critics. And this comedy is beyond all description. Pardon mon direction et cinématographie. An example of cinema médiocrité, or Jerry Lewisism, as we say.
He's a master, man.
One of the heron.
The show starts in about 4 minutes.
An Uber.
No, the painting.
The Overman.
What about the painting?
When is the painting
going to
start? I thought this was a painting party.
No.
This is the rescue party.
No. That's just on the radio. We've got to get Studio A and Studio B painted before the sun comes up.
Well, don't let us bother you, but remember those toxic fumes may cause.
This is not toxic fumes.
We're talking about the work party.
Where have you been for the past?
We've been talking about the work party. See, we're talking about the rescue party.
I didn't know there was a party at all. I'm not sure I have time to go.
It's a painting party.
You mean like a body painting party?
Yeah, I think
No.
I think the body corpus of KPFA is painted by all of the people listening.
It's psychedelic.
No, this is a bonding painting party.
Oh, that's, I get it.
We're going to bond by painting each other's bodies.
Right.
Well, and what does this have to do with the price of peas in
Peoria?
Thank you.
No, thank you.
That was a really nice
Were you
nice
listening to this
of,
horrific story of
that,
the Rangers?
That was a nice story about that guy's bubbly skin.
It's a book called Death in Yellowstone.
I like
And
death.
All it
I
is
like,
is constant
like
stories
bubbly.
Of
that's the, I think that's
poor
the
little people dropping into the little hot pools and trying to slide out. And Michael Pepe knows this firsthand.
Anyway.
He stepped in such a pool.
I like to
burned his little feet off and also.
And then there was another dog incident, despite the one that they mentioned. That is, besides that one.
Where the Black Rock dog one?
Yes.
Yeah, same. Basically the same story, only it happened near our beloved Playa.
Yeah.
A young lady and her dog gamboled, I should say, toward a pool. It was probably about 200 degrees or a little bit more. And the happy dog jumped in the pool and immediately began to parboil. And eyes go white. And it takes a little while longer for the dog because of that nice fur coat they have on. But all the exposed areas like nose and eyes, yeah, those parboil immediately. So the dog's now yelping and dying. And the human jumps in to save the dog.
A valiant but unfortunately costly gesture.
In fact, there's a lot of that in there. The entire book is nothing but people getting drunk and falling asleep in the snow. Or people falling into pools and then screaming all night.
A terrible situation.
And it is a situation.
Yes, a certain situation. Well, we have other films coming up on our giant multi-screen screenatorium. We get to watch them in our robes and slippers in palatial...
Want some more cookies, Al?
Comfort. Oh, no, thank you. Not right now. Maybe just in a moment. So, you see, we'll watch these art films and drink white wine.
I've never seen so many scratches on the television. So what else has been on? There was something else on. Oh, The Climb, the story of John Law's youth.
Oh, they had that on?
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, you can't keep up with everything.
Which has a wonderful scene of John Hurt taking an arrow in the arm, much like the Sheriff of Nottingham in the early lithographs that I looked at as a kid. One of my favorite lithos was poor Sheriff of Nottingham getting an arrow right through the elbow with a grinning Robin Hood in the trees.
That just sounds fired sadistic.
It.
And
yes, it was. And I kept thinking as a kid, that would be really awful. You know, that would screw up that arm forever. But they portrayed it as a joke. And the little grinning Robin Hood, of course, I thought, what a great guy.
Sheriff's
kind of have fun. But Justin. Robin Hood always is. Hey, what's the men in tight pants? That's the true Robin Hood.
But they all wore those. It's not just Robin Hood, who was a pervert. They wore a hose, and it keeps your legs warm.
Like Michael Pepe, of course.
Yes. He's a fashion statement in himself.
Yeah, at this point, I could actually and should actually do Michael Pepe, Volume 1, of all the video in bits and pieces.
Or the PBS special, The Secret Life of Michael Pepe, which was a candidate for... Oh, well, it was banned, but it was a candidate for Emmy Awards and so forth. It was mentioned, supposedly, to show the courage of the Academy. And they even mentioned this film had been...
I thought it was just empathy and sympathy for this poor, tortured creature that was...
Well, I think that is what really is behind it, I'm sure.
See, here he is driving. You know,
there's
driving.
A certain amount of social hypocrisy.
Yeah.
Now, people won't admit their actual motives. They are too challenged by a work of great art when it first pops into their midst.
I don't know how to think about it. How come she ain't got arms?
Well, now, that's a matter for the experts. Sure, there must be a good reason.
We've called the experts down. The police have shown up instead of the experts. We're going
the
to
missing arms
the
of Venus, eh? What a story.
Apparently the police are looking for the missing arms because it was mentioned on the show that the arms were missing.
Yes,
so there's got to be a problem here.
The arms for sausages scandal, which occurred earlier, was nothing in comparison to the missing arms of Venus caper.
You know, Doggy Diner still loves Hedy Lamarr.
And he still floats proudly above the waves.
Yes. How long? In fact, does Little Doggy Diner have to
Wasn't there some strange stalemate?
Maybe.
It's like when they try to save the giant camera.
Yeah. Well, they did save the giant camera.
They have to keep doing it again and again.
Yeah.
Keep saving the giant camera over and over.
Come on, everybody. Now the crowds of somnolent sounds.
Did I ever eat a doggy and have a dinner at the Doggy Diner? I can't really recall, but I think maybe once I did. It wasn't particularly that good, but at least I contributed to a legend.
Also, isn't the Little Doggy Diner head going to a special museum head hole place somewhere?
Well, I heard some rumor to that effect, but I didn't think the matter had been, resolved.
Yeah, because I think part of the fun is it will now be in a big indoor place, which is always nice because the scale is so off and you see the big head. Not the Arnold Palmer head. Oops.
But is this head really meant to be viewed up close? Isn't it supposed to be seen from the street level? It's an interesting multi-dimensional object with more personality than most stripped-down commercial icons. Yes, most advertising creations no longer have the perk and sizzle of such advertising creations of the past as Speedy Alka-Seltzer, Manners, the Midget Butler, even the Jolly Green Giant, who only became jolly in the later part of his career. Yes,
he had so much land that he owned, and he would just laugh, ho, ho, ho.
Well, at first he would appear as the huge, hulking guardian of the garden plot. That mystical spot where all the vegetables were grown for this giant vegetable company.
And when you looked behind him, the valley went on forever and ever. All the food that all the people in the world ever ate was grown right there between his legs.
Yes, and he stood there. And this chain-smoking ad executive, whose name I can't remember, added jolly to the concept because the Green Giant was an advertising icon in the 30s and wasn't around for a long time.
Right.
But then the whole idea of the good things from the garden in the valley of the jolly, ho, 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 Green Giant, was
who
his guy's inspiration.
Need I remind you, much like a green alien.
Oh, yes,
who
with
would
pointed ears
your
like
bed at night.
Mr. Spock. And,
test your bot. Oops, I guess I'm not supposed to talk about that. They shut off the music pipe.
And then the correspondent to the dwarfish grays, the legendary aliens, would be the Green Giant's accomplice, the little green sprout.
One of the things I love about my role here at KPFA is I get to hear directly from you, our listeners. My name is Italina, donor relations manager here at the station, and I get to hear things like, thank you for being here for our community. And we get to be here thanks to loyal listeners like you. So help us continue to be here by making a meaningful donation today. And know there is more than one way to donate. You can make a qualified charitable distribution from an IRA, You can donate stocks. You can even add KPFA as a beneficiary. Thank you for being really thoughtful about this. Thank you to our monthly sustainers and to our generous one-time donors. Donate at kpfa.org or email members@kpfa.org if you have a question about donating in other ways or if you'd like to increase your monthly donation. My name is Italina, here for Community Powered Radio, here for you.
KPFA's paid staff are a union. Hosts, producers, engineers, reporters, anchors, technical employees, phone room coordinators, event producers, trabajadores de instalaciones. We are part of Communications Workers of America, Local 9415, AFL-CIO. Because unity makes strength and unions make great media. Together with KPFA's unpaid staff and volunteers and every one of you who donate, we make KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KPFB 89.3 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, and 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and kpfa.org.
He was short with a large head,
Popeye spinach,
large eyes.
Who would measure the who would measure up to the Grays in vegetable packaging?
You know, everything you know is wrong, and it turns out that spinach is bad for kids. I suppose you followed that to scientific discovery.
Yes, I saw that. And I was,
it actually weakens their bones and steals iron.
What we've
from
been
them.
Doing for the test to Texas is force feed 10 children with Popeye spinach, and look, they're all floppy.
I used to love to get just get a good can of spinach and then, you know, wolf it down, you know, raw right out of the can. No.
I like it raw,
it's
but
really
I almost
tasty.
Hate it out of the can because it was like this little limpy leaf thing.
Yeah, well, it's limp. It's like those Popeye cartoons condition you to think of it as a huge mass of entangled fiber, looking something like a wet beard or something, held in the hand downed in one convulsive chewing
cup of Manteca.
And then, of course, the muscles bulge. Music starts playing.
If I was 5 years old and I found those cans of Popeye spinach, I probably would have downed 10 of them in an attempt to get muscles easily. With a picture of, you know, that kind of identification right on the label, it's like, wow.
Besides which, it tastes good.
I don't feel so well. I eat 15 cans of Popeye spinach.
Some of the virtue of it has been stolen. The fibrous nature of it has been vitiated to some degree, but still, it's a lot more healthy than some
it
things.
It makes those kids all floppy.
Oh, yes, they're jelly-like now. Jellyfish kids.
From eating spinach, which withdrew all the vitamins and minerals that all the other food gave them.
It's going to be even bigger than Cabbage Patch Kids and Garbage Pail Kids put together.
Which one's that?
Jellyfish Kids.
Oh, yeah. You can get three of them in these little packages and then put them in water and pwing! The little cities grow. What thing is they look like? Udus, planet of the eyeballs.
You see, there's where the hundreds of lovable live sea monkeys commute to on their way to work.
So the sea monkeys' future was assured.
It's another world, one that we're only beginning to understand.
That's why they have this theremin music. Oh, sorry. I didn't see you. I didn't know you were in the spooky movie.
I didn't know you had a theremin player there. Won't you introduce me to your friend?
That's just Hal. No. Oh, come on, man. It's all right. We just want to say hi to her. Oh, look what you did.
Well, I often have that effect on people. Perhaps I shouldn't have shown her my
credentials. Yeah, I might as well put that away, Hal. I don't think that was well received.
On the scholarly advance from one colleague to another.
Well, that's what happens in all alien movies.
That's true.
The
you
theremin
can't tell
plays, the woman
who's
screams.
Who.
Yep. The guys can turn into jellyfish kids. And then put on the roof. Like,
we can joke about jellyfish kids, but such things actually have happened before in benighted periods of human history. And of course, go back a relatively short distance in time to approximately the time following the fall of the Roman Empire and Then the earth was beset by strange monsters.
Oh, okay. Well, now we're in the Roman Empire, but it's just little skeletons everywhere.
Roman Empire's kind of fallen to pieces, but out in the woods there are dragons and things like that. Not only dragons, but unicorns and griffins. And not only griffins, but wyverns. And not only wyverns, but basilisks, manticores, an entire grotesque bestiary. The hippogriff fluttered from tree to tree, and a giant griffin was a fearsome thing to see. Well,
we're going to try to see if we can capture this griffin with us.
Then there were giants, ogres, wood woozles, dwarfs, not dwarves, which is a modern linguistic abomination, and elves. Yes, there were elves.
We have this elf on life support. I think we should kill him before anybody
finds out
they exist.
There were many pre-human races competing with our ancestors.
Okay,
some of them science knows about
support.
And even gives grudging acknowledgement.
They exist.
Some say that they are not truly dead, but still survive.
This one is.
Hidden with superhuman cleverness.
Go ahead, get him out
in
of here.
Remote areas of the Earth.
I had to do it.
The prehistoric Gigantopithecus, for example, may still lurk in regions of China's vast, unexplored.
And here's the funeral that we gave the little alien. We took him up to Yellowstone.
And unfortunately, he fell in one of those geysers, you know, but he regenerated, and he swore he'd find us for doing this. And
there's
not only we, but our whole planet would pay. And just for now, I guess it wasn't time for us to meet.
No, until the next episode of Time for Us to Pay.
Now that toupee looks worse on every episode.
Oh, fatal.
Oh, no, I didn't mean anything.
This is Juan Bosch. And
Ralph Skinnerd saying it's been wonderful towing that trail with you once again in the sky.
And so, we'll see you next
stay
time.
High.
There are aliens around.
And underground, don't forget.
This is the show that never ends.
And under the sea.
So stand by for more show.
More alien extravaganza coming up at the bottom of the half hour. And we're going to see those 3D alien stereoscopic pornographic slides that we've been promised by resident alien experts.
Up, oh, and there goes, come on, man, get out of the way.
Yes, I must mention that these are illegal in certain states, and listening to this broadcast may make you, the listener, culpable in a federal crime.
So
now
if
this,
you feel
necessary
that you don't want to be involved in this, turn your radio off now.
By the Standards and Practices and Sausage Making Board of Northern California.
They're so, your neighbors, too.
They're humans, just like me and you. Or are they? It could be their ETs, strange bone-dead monsters from another world.
Let's look in their bedroom windows.
That is,
now,
if they come from
we?
A dry planet. Yes, they could be bone-dry without moisture in their bodies. Horrible. Ghastly. But then the Venusians are fouler still.
Hydrators to sleep.
Yes, I suppose so. No point in talking about the old, oh, good God, the bubbling magma of Titan, the caves of Uranus, the rings of Saturn.
Here come the Rangers. They'll save us.
Suffering asteroids. Those aren't Rangers.
Oh, my God.
That isn't
they're,
regulation
of course,
uniform.
Aliens.
They've got big heads and large, weird-looking eyeballs.
Well, you know they're aliens when you can see through those eyes.
Malnourished individuals with sunglasses on.
Yeah, or John Sayles or something like that. But they're probably aliens.
Well, you know, it still seems improbable, even in the face of this direct evidence.
I think I'll just have a cigarette instead.
Yes, we should relax and not be stampeded by the sudden appearance of aliens.
Let's just think about this.
Behaving in any way that we would under normal circumstances.
You know, the more I smoke this strange cigarette, the more paranoid
it soothes the nerves, doesn't it? You know, even with the alien standing right there.
Yeah, sure, Hal. Who's that alien? Well, I can't even see him, and he's walking around behind me.
Oh, I can't see what he's doing either. I can't turn around.
Where is he?
Stuck here. Get away, boy. Leave me alone.
Skip. He's in the wrong movie.
Yes, I wish he'd skip out of here. Get out.
Right, go some, find some toilet to climb into.
Oh, that's disgusting. Wow, it almost sounds like he understood
you there.
That's
what Skip does in the movie. See, that's,
yes,
that's
at iSkip.com. Right, it's a very happy movement. Yes, right there. Right.
Not unlike
somebody.
The Predator.
Well, we can't control
very
these
much
things.
Like the Predator, I think.
Yes, or something, yes.
Little spooky digital effects.
Yes, of a rushing stream carrying the ordure away.
Wow. What a line. Out of this station and into the street. There they go. Okay, now he's turned on to the highway.
Now that's for a matter for the street sweepers to make a clean sweep of the streets.
What should they like doing at this hour? Attempting to make the show go away was the quote.
They're about prowling around.
And so the Mapes Hotel fell down, went boom.
Now I'm sure it's a matter of interest to your listeners, Ray, that the cash register from the Mapes Hotel, which was later used for target practice by crazed Burning Man participants, will be up for auction and on display at the forthcoming Las Vegas extravaganza this Saturday.
How wonderful.
Yes, won't be. To see that thing again, and to see it in its last incarnation before it disappears into some souvenir hound's private fossilized collection.
I wonder what that will bring. That'll be interesting.
God knows.
He does? She does? It does?
Well, presumably.
Everywhere I look, the little pools of hot water.
No, yes, bubbling and burbling, the magma of the underground.
I'm just going to take this bus around the station.
The heat of inner earth is greater than some humans can understand.
Wow, inside this alien spaceship is like walking around Vaseline.
They like it hot in here, too, don't they? Boy, I wouldn't want to travel in one of these things. Not looking back.
It's like bone matter.
Loathsome. This makes me hate those things.
I think we're at the wrong end of this thing.
And the stench, I've got to tell you.
Damn it.
I put up with most things, but...
Okay, I just broke through to the caller.
Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, man, I can't breathe in here.
Come on, speak up. It's building up. We haven't got much time.
Damn, I think we're at the wrong end.
Well, it doesn't matter. We can't escape the explosion. The blast radius is too great.
Oh, my God!
Fantastic. It's actually shot us down the tube at the speed of a bullet. Why, we're being propelled along by one of nature's inevitable reactions.
Wow. Oh, that's sort of like a fart, but an alien.
Well, it's like it's in Jules Verne.
Hey, that one smells great.
Yeah, well, that's because we're going too fast for our noses to register the ugly odor.
I see.
But be careful not to touch the walls of the shaft. They're red hot, and we are traveling very fast.
Well, Doctor, how can we get back to Earth?
Why, we are being returned to the surface of the Earth at a speed greater than 100 miles an hour. As the lava rises, above it is a column of hot mud. And above that, if there still is any, the water, which is boiling off around us, as you can see.
I saw a little frog sign of good luck.
Well, there are many wonders down here that we shall never understand. But silence, I don't want my pet duck to fall off the raft.
Where is the raft?
I can't. Now I'm confused. It was right under our feet.
We're standing on the collar.
Oh, sorry, excuse me. There's a call, I believe. Perhaps you should, as the nominal commander of this expedition, I doubt if they'd want to speak to me, so...
The caller's brain was hung up upon. But and join us here in the frog-filled field. I hear it's a good luck sign.
Yes, in the swamp here bongs the gongs of a throng of frogs.
We're still building the field, so pardon the mechanics here.
Just listen to that frog croak. Oh, that's more like a horse, actually. But...
These digital effects, I think they're misnumbered. Okay, here, I'm going to punch in something else.
Getting punchy until he's drunk with tar.
pushing buttons and twisting knobs up here,
taking
high above
names
Berkeley,
and
sending these little radio thunderbolts out to all the other stations.
It's an awesome power.
So, yes, we'll drop this radio bomb right.
Well, I believe that one must be for you.
Okay. You're on. Oh, well, see, it wasn't anybody at all.
You're on Candid.
Yes.
Well, see, there he is. That's the film of the former caller hanging up on the show.
Really? Grown humans, it's astonishing anyone would act this way, but what can I say?
He'll. Take your coat off. Wait a minute. They're searching everybody on the show now.
No, I do not want to buy a duck.
Is that some old radio joke?
It was Joe Pinner. A comedian known for just that line, wanna buy a duck?
Did you happen to see the Fiesta de Santa Barbara?
Fiesta de Santa Barbara.
The guy that's on the highway right now is had on tape where they sing La Cucaracha, the Garland sisters sing it.
Wow.
And there's even a shot of, now I can't remember his name, the character on, he was Zorro's buddy.
Sergeant Garcia?
He's holding a cucaracha in the refrain of the song. He sings the refrain alone.
Holding a cucaracha? You mean a real one?
Yeah, and mimicking the effects of said cucaracha. These were the 40s, or rather late 30s, folks, in Hollywood, in Technicolor. And Hubba Hubba, right after Idol of Eno, there's a young starlet that... A bombshell blonde gets out of the wagon that I'd like to know what happened to her. Maybe she married a mogul and never got to the movie parts.
That often happens.
Sure was a possibility back then when things were gay in old Hollywood.
Oh, they still have intergenerational sex there. It's one of the few places where it's tolerated.
There is a human at the other end. We're hypnotizing you into saying...
Hello, you on the air. Speak up, humanoid.
No, I'm sorry. We had to drop the caller dead on you and drop you down the shaft of the imaginary radio, spooky haunted house, and alien abduction center.
Wow.
And now the body is sunk into the mud below the station.
The sky above, the mud below.
Ooh. Terrible place to hang out. I'm sorry, the abattoir of radio waves here.
And if the marsh tarantulas get on you, well, it's rather hard to get rid of the effects of that.
At least it's not the William Shatner impersonator who you were locked in a room with for 18 hours. That's the true horrible world.
An impersonator, you say?
Yes. It's not unlike being Chicken John doing Elvis for 18 hours in a small room, and you can't get out. And then, damn it, the Wonder Dog jumps all up in your face.
Oh, this is terrible.
Well, it's a title. This is what happens as people go nuts at the very...
What, at the bong cuckoo part of the show?
No, the sight of the shot up cash register. See, they all went crazy and fawn over it? Yes, you all went crazy and fawn over it.
Well,
never mind. Well, you know what? Who we should call, and I don't have a number, is Fantasy Girl, you know. How can I say this?
Well, whose fantasy is it this time?
The young Justin.
Oh.
Who always said, call any time. I'm sure she'd laugh and laugh now that she doesn't have a job, but I don't have her number. So
sorry, sad.
Callers. We'll have
Now she goes by the moniker of Justin Credible.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I haven't seen that incarnation. But then, who has? Here on the show. And I had a real Doug Smith moment at Burning Man last year where Justin Credible and Burning Dove and I broke into Larry Harvey's cabin and bothered him mightily. He was trying desperately to get some sleep and the two young ladies were jumping up and down and I'm videotaping and we're all laughing. And it's like, we had done this with poor Ivan Stang years ago many times. as the poor head of the cult is just trying to get some CP. And the Bobbies and the Devilettes won't let him see. He gets too much is better than not enough as a lifestyle. Yes, and this is what happens. Movie music and screams for the rest of your life.
Hello?
Hello, we're starting the show now.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air. If you want to air beef that you might have or... just chew the fat a little bit. Yeah, we're right here, and we're ready to communicate.
To the window. Go away! Go away!
It seems like a little schizophrenic here. We're both attracting and repelling at the same time. Oh, look at that. A grotesque close-up of this essential metamorphosis. Being given birth to from the egg of, a frog. It's not a tadpole this time. It's, I think, some incarnation, some earlier form or proto-form of Michael Peckley.
I'm going to stomp on it there. It's over. It's all right, Hal. It's dead.
No, well, that was unfortunate. I was interested in observing its development and growth.
You can't let those things go on too long. You let these little Pepe things grow and...
I know, and become huge, lumbering, ungainly monsters.
You show up at 4 a.m. every place. See?
Wow.
A 60-foot Michael Pepe terrorizing 4:30 a.m. San Francisco.
That really is awful. I mean, even scarier than the deadly mantis. Of course, that wasn't too scary. Unless the idea of a mile-long bug... puts fear into your heart. Now, as for me, it simply seems a surreal disconnect, you know.
Not unlike the worm in Ants, where you can climb on its back and take a ride to a rotten apple.
Well, that sounds like a hell of a lot of fun.
I think the pizza's here. All right, thanks.
If you could somehow avoid being injured or punctured by the worm's bristling sea tide.
Fat chance, little boy. Billy and Timmy are here to join you.
Good Lord, it looks as if they've been punctured 1,000 times by needles.
Want to ride the worm?
That's enough of that. We're not going to ride the worm today. Billy and Timmy are so tired, and they have learned to obey Aunt Bertha at all times.
I'm afraid, Aunt Bertha, we found Billy and Timmy are filching chocolate from old Uncle Joe's store.
Oh, my. How could you?
We'll have to take him to the penitentiary for 11 years.
Oh, Billy.
And so Billy and Timmy began doing the time.
I'm sorry, Aunt Bertha. I let you down.
And I let Jesus down.
Well, you boys are going to have to go away for a while. But through the long years, I and the Children's Bible Hour will be waiting for your return. And then your sins shall be washed white as the snowy fleece of the Lamb of God. All right, men, take them away.
And throw away the key. Hey. Right, Aunt Bertha. Years passed. Slowly. Agonizingly slowly.
In the cell of Billy and Timmy.
Oh, they got to be in one cell together?
Yeah.
Well, that's not too bad.
16 other child.
They got to know each other until they loved each other, but then they hated each other.
Everybody drawing those little useless marks on the wall, showing years going by.
Well, you're not allowed to do that. That's defacing the wall. You get punishment for that, and you have to repaint the wall yourself. Mm-hmm. And they toss yourself for contraband. There's nothing. You got nothing, and you are nothing. All because you wouldn't obey Aunt Bertha's simple rules for health, hygiene, and Christian endeavor.
Why'd see Aunt Bertha flying around my head?
Yeah, it looks like she's sitting on a broom, Carrot Top.
What's wrong with me? I'm gonna break her.
You're having a hallucination.
I gotta get out of here.
You're not going anywhere. Those bars will see to that.
What the hell is going on?
That's what many of us would like to know here at the tumultuous post-20th century entity known as the present age.
Yeah.
What the hell do you think you're doing?
What's well, I, old Pastor Stang often gets excited when he considers the vast possibilities offered by Subco at this historic time in our nation's history. In an election year, sure to determine the intellectual and philosophical fate of the next decade, perhaps even casting an iron shadow over the forthcoming century.
Whoa.
The Bush dynasty, the beginning of the events which was to produce the cumulative disaster of World War VI, cannot be enumerated in this historical document. But aside from that, everything's going to be real groovy, and there'll be new pop sensations that'll make Britney Spears look like the last year's cabbage. Yes, you'll have your indulgent foo-for-all and terradiddle until the iron meat cleaver of grim irrationality descends with a hideous swoosh.
Wow, it's so sad in the future.
Well, you know, we've got to face up to it. We're sapping the world of its vitality.
Great shot for us.
And when that is gone, we, the parasites upon it, will die.
I need a life to go my way.
What is that a picture of?
It's really cool. I mean, where the original is. Yeah, of course, they don't give...
It looks like there's a kid falling there.
Yeah,
oh,
it's sort of like a Titanic.
No, I see.
Saving the child.
Women's and children's first, and here's a children's that you forgot.
One of those... And also, think of how much it must have been to flock this thing.
In those days, you could flock, I tell you.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, that such an exquisite item must be contained by a platter of such unpleasant effulgence. Yes, I'm no fan of them brothers. I thought their time was a dark time for civilization.
Oh, you mean the 70s time?
Yes.
Before that, that's the producer's fault. They met a producer who made them do that. But in the years of the Beatles, they were the best fake Beatles ever. Because they started playing music when they were 12. And they just imitated what was around them. And for the... Earliest times, I thought they were really fun to listen to because their lyrics were really crazy and everything was sad and weird. And then they became, the icon, the famousest icons of the world afterwards. And then, the whole world went down the tubes on that one, folks, you have to admit.
Well, it seems I've misjudged them once again.
The early 70s, that is. I mean, look at the hair and the pants alone.
And just some perverse element seized hold of the ethos. Some hideous element which, in a sense, has never relinquished its stranglehold and distorts...
You know what's happening is... Hey, man, cut it out, thanks. It was after you watched that Nixonite thing...
Well, you got my message about Nixon.
That tends to color everything, I think.
You know, they're out to get Nixon.
Boy, yeah, I love that stuff, man.
Looks like they're just out to get Nixon.
It's fun to have an obsessionary target because the Bogman and Baker 18 and I stayed at a home in Alamogordo, New Mexico a few years ago where the people, our host and hostess, were obsessed with this wonderful, jowly, constantly almost bearded man.
They called me King Dick.
So King I Dick. Gathered together a huge box of stuff. And, of course, mailed it from Nixon, Nevada.
There's a little Nixon in all of us.
To them to say thank you. That was the most fun going there because not only was we living in a 300-year-old adobe house, but it snowed a foot and a half that night. And I went out with their dog, and we did much what you were talking about early in the show with the horrible snow drifts and... I just hiked around in the drifts.
Now, the purpose of of telling that particular story was to warn others about the lurking pool of hidden bubbling hot springs?
Yes. If you see this pool, arrest it immediately.
Well, that sounds like a salutary behavior, but didn't you say it was possible to fall right into it before you even knew it was there? My God, I'll watch my feet.
If you're out there in a blizzard, certainly.
Oh, in a blizzard.
Part of the problem is that you get close to the edge, and then you slip, if you slip into one of these. The sides, it's much like a big cereal bowl, and the sides are very slippery with minerals. So there's it's really difficult to get out of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And when it's 200 degrees or more, you tend to leave all the exterior skin, whatever you're touching. So you just go down to the muscle and bone by the time you get to the tent. And you come to the conclusion of your life slowly and very consciously, as the young ranger found out in this story. And there are pools that you can go have a nice swim in, like the ones in that we are familiar with.
But they have to be downstream considerably from the point of emergence of hot water. Well, most regrettable and truly terrible story, because you have somebody who it's impossible to help.
Yeah. It's like the ranger. It's always a ranger, too. The ranger who watched the flight going, now retired number flight 261, to be standing on the side of the island watching something like that occur is it's a life-changing event. An
orphanage full of 35 kids, I gotta go for a Sunday drive. Well, what's this about an orphanage?
Just get some rest, now.
I'm also supposed to host a Valentine's Day party for Lady Chimmerly at the Hush Hush.
When is that?
I guess it would be Valentine's Day. Yes, the time of high romance. In the spring, a young man's fancy lightly turns to faults of love. And before you know it, there's 35 kids and...
And they're all killers.
Yes,
because they've been locked up with Billy and Timmy.
Well, they were warped and twisted by their years behind bars and emerged as psychotic menaces to society. Ruthless predators. Prowling the night of our streets.
Armed with guns and knives, they change the lives of the citizens everywhere.
With their bad attitude.
They didn't know how to be polite. They didn't want to be polite.
If they worried about anything, it wasn't good manners.
So
they were as quick as they were deadly.
We can't show you that part of the film, though.
No, really? Oh, I guess because it's a TVMA, suggested for Victor Mature audiences only.
Yeah, subjected to my church audiences only.
Yeah, well, screw all that. I mean, pardon my French, but isn't it time to rip aside the veils of secrecy and allow the public to gaze upon the unveiled form of...
Let people see Channel X?
Yes, just so. X shall mark this body. In this case, all we need to do is declassify this one little file. I've prepared this copy for your signature.
Oh, okay.
And
sign here.
All right.
And here. I think we have them now, just where we want them.
That's two words, puzzling evidence, right?
Yeah, .com.
Oh my, another startup company. Starting up.
Come on, folks, let's start up. We gotta get out of here.
Gotta rev this information-fueled economy and rise to heights of financial prosperity undreamed of by Andrew Carnegie and J.P. Morgan put together. Those old capitalist dinosaurs are nothing compared to the giant Godzilla-like behemoths of financial capital around the world. But in ancient days, it was the same. The elves, as I said, they ruled the woods. Now a wyvern, you asked what was a wyvern. Well, you know what a griffin is like, right? Well, a wyvern is, what is a wyvern? It's sort of like a griffin, except that it's only got two legs and has bat-like wings rather than the bird-like wings of a griffin. There you go. I think the head may be wrong, but oh well, forget it. And they were only about 5 feet high, but they'd be a big menace in the woods in those days, believe you me.
I'm still hooked up on the little, oh darn, I forgot the little numbers. The little tiny Ray Harryhausen, the little spirit, the little evil, meany little fly, leathery girl spirits that they use in the Adventures of Sinbad. The not Harridans.
The harpies. Yeah.
These harpies. Boy, I'd love to have a bunch of little harpies in a jar to do my bidding.
You let them out and they flap around.
Yeah, and go do mean stuff. So you wouldn't have to do the mean stuff. See, little harpies would do it for you. Music like this would play all the time.
Well, in the Golden Voyage of Sinbad, there was a little flying homunculus that Sorcerer Kura created to be his long-distance eyes.
Yeah,
he was Kura. In telepathic rapport with this tiny mannequin. Is that the being
that's
you were referring
the one.
To?
That's the one.
Yes. Well, you see, they flutter and flap.
God, when's a commercial come up on this show?
Didn't you hear? There was a decision made about that. There will not be a commercial here until the end of time. Until the sun flares out in one final nuclear explosion.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess that means we're on the air until the end of time.
Well, I didn't mean to suggest that, and I would certainly hate to be held to any such belief in a contractual sense. This document isn't really binding. It's
now it is. You just
gee,
laser signed it.
They,
would you press that?
No, they are doing it. We've gone too far. They are taking it over from us. The whole business of legal fiction is a moot point now.
Well, here, the law is moot and point.
Hello? I was just having the damnedest dream. Oh, it's you. 3 minutes later, I'd shaved and dressed and run down the stairs to street level. I leaped into my car and drove as fast as I could through the busy city streets toward the Institute.
That's what everybody does. They drive toward the Institute when things go wrong.
I could only think of Janine's warm breath as I threaded my way through traffic. How different from the hectic scene which now faced me. Yes, it was a happy world. Pitted against a super criminal with this insane power, what could my maneuver be?
Yes, he makes people laugh and laugh and laugh.
I should change into my long underwear and assume my sacred identity as the Crimson Blast. I really must get these things laundered.
What a beautiful, wonderful world it will be when the show stops.
Yes, you'll all experience that, and rather sooner than later, I should say, by my way of reckoning.
And the world will be beautiful again, and MGM music will play, and only flowers will occur.
Yes, flowers will bloom, and the tomtit wren will once again flutter across the sky.
It's always that same damn bird.
Well, the earth shall bear forth fruits and living things, each of its kind.
And Michael Pepe will marry Donna Reed and give give birth to a whole new civilization.
After being paid back in full by
Chicken John. So you've been watching the Michael Pepe story once again here on a radio station in your mind.
A product of Pepe Lou Studios.
Pepe Lou Studios is represented by the Lou Crayon Comedians.
No animals, unicorns, hippogriffs, or basilisks were harmed during the making of this program. All rights reserved. See the product of a thousand years brought into play. See the mystic rites of an ancient priesthood. Smell the odor of corruption in Super Smell-O-Vision and Bubble Scope. As International Calamity Pictures brings you Michael Pepe, the Avenger of Tomorrow.
I saw it, and I just can't believe those mind-breaking special effects. I mean, it was incredible. You've got to see this one.
Yes, folks, join us next week for Michael Pepe, Avenger of Tomorrow, our new series.
Yes, it'll be a change in our usual pattern of broadcasting, and we hope that you'll enjoy it.
See Michael Pepe prance in his underwear.
And it's going to be hours long, isn't that right? I mean, yes, it's going to go on and on. It's yes. It's going to
no,
be...
No, that's not next week. That's next week becomes the many long shows.
I see. All right. Well, I understand.
It will be
now.
Impossible for you to tape or take.
Yes, that's true. Too much. But as we say, too much is always better than not enough. And so we bid you a beef fondue.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Not likely to be offended by iambic pentameter or skilled photography.
Britain's largest
cordless mouth
selling cigarettes.
With a full barrel, with a full barrel, cement light is set to land inside a bed of spider web. You and the pig, jump off of the bridge. And if you can't do it again,
why not? Blow your brain out. I'm blowing mine out.
What should I do?
Yeah.
All right, the director's cut, yeah.
All right, try to speak up a little, Carl. I think what you just said was you pooped in your fiance's cat box.
Yeah.
Weather, traffic, household hints, the happy beat of the action sound.
Praise song for the day.
What's happening gets around on radio. What's happening in town?
That was weird.
Oh! Pink hearts!
date my person. Why am I setting an anchor down?
Seven. To make it difficult, Annie. What's the sense of understanding? If you have symptoms, get help.
Or feel clear, or walk, or talk clear.
All right, so none of this is real.
Can it beat the system, the 666 system, Jack?
I didn't
say
that. It's real.
Welcome on the show.
3M is what?
Oh, yeah. Yes, great guidance.
Just because they want to. I know about these things because I've been through it.
Is that not part of the plan?
My wife and I both try to quit smoking.
To act like the human, to feel like the human. Why is this not part of the plan? You are a Roman, and a Roman you shall remain.
One, I set
you in motion.
I invite you now to listen.
Never.
We're not physically addicted anyway.
What has happened is over a period of time,
you have trained yourself on the subconscious level
to respond with a need for a cigarette.
There,
you
got it.
I got it, but I don't want it.
Or when you're relaxed,
you're able to learn a lot more
and retain
not peaceful. Your attention is important.
Subconscious does not know right or wrong.
Good or bad.
It only knows to do what it has been trained to do.
Iraqi tank. American pilot.
hit this man, us, and all the communists in there.
Well, the restless ever show and the souls that breathe within, I'm tired of treading. When there's some place else to swim, I'm praying for something that's worth drowning for.
Of course, the president is
hippest
to save the country.
Now come on.
Still reacting with the need for the cigarette.
And I'll never be afraid to throw me over. All the undercurrents rage, just give me something.
So the show begins.
Transport. It's like Idiot Flesh, but it's like right now.
I were us, I get on the internet, send out a major distress signal.
The show is on the air.
Can't get to internet.
Man,
getting sorry, ugly man. In here.
Oh.
At TM, we listen to you.
Wait, Vocaloids, go home now.
But somehow, I'd never cooled anyone.
Sleep now.
Hello?
Yes.
So,
some goddamn time.
Yeah.
Inside of me?
Cylon, not like.
Yeah. Hey, can you pass that stuff over here?
I mean, you dudes are messing with some heavy, heavy stuff.
It's like electronic paxophobia.
A guy can't ever get enough of that.
But, a lethal. Well, there's always puzzling evidence out of you. But that is an existential application which can be applied.
Sleep now.
Yeah, good. I'll probably dream I'm on the radio. That's what cheers them up.
I think those who are like that should end tonight, and I should just, like, terminate it.
And
the wild
bye. And we'll just turn ourselves over. From now on, those who are like that.
Is that contract talk?
No, those who are like that will be on from 10 o'clock until 10:02, the length of playing Whitey on the Moon.
He said, Whitey on the Moon.
It'll turn itself over to the puzzling evidence.
Well, I guess I gotta go. I mean, I've got to buy.
I will be here for those 2 minutes of playing Whitey on the Moon.
Yeah, these nose beads keep me on my back. Otherwise,
I get my radio credit.
You know yourself, he's being in.
On the spot radio.
There you go.
Hey, how about that 30-second spot?
The night has a thousand shows.
Me heartily on the shoulder. You are completely cured.
What do you do when you're on Fridays?
He began.
But who knows?
I'm going to have to look it up. This time I have the computer.
So, Dr. Hal, of course, are you going to be on Puzzling Evidence on Monday mornings?
I dislike his seconds. Laugh because well, I hear his voice.
I don't know.
I hope
so. I hear yourself.
Where he was going.
It's no different.
Anything.
No, there's the background check.
Just the security procedure. You can opt for the private room. And
please place the specimen.
Early names by Fruity Cutie and Sassy Strawberry.
We found old yes, Sassy Strawberry, Larrabing Lemon.
What if the creatures from the Black Lagoon came on the show? KPFA would love me
Well, that would be something out of the ordinary. Something they have to think up of a lot of new adjectives.
As though accepting the intrusion, when in fact I felt collusion.
I'm sorry, the show is not even
pale and rosy by turns, as Louis bent over her small gloved fingers. No, it just takes care of the hind legs and the tail.
Hey, wait, no, let me get the right ones.
You'll be all part
surrounds us all in here. Shimmering and surroundings.
In England.
The Wall of Sound.
Emeryville.